Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Rob Harrell. You know him as the writer of Monster on the Hill, the graphic novel that the hit movie on Paramount Plus Rumble is based. Now join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Harrell. Welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me. This is very cool. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure, sir. I was very happy to have a chance to read your book and get to watch the movie that was based on the book. And it's a great honor to be able to do so.
Yeah, well, yeah, loosely based, but
I didn't notice that. It's definitely very loosely based.
Yeah. Okay. No, I'm thrilled to be here to talk about it and to talk about the book hopefully some new people get to discover it.
Yeah, and I thought it was really cool in reading about you that you're a dual threat. You're an artist and a writer.
Yeah, I'm starting to figure that out. It took me a long time. I think I always thought of myself as a cartoonist or an artist. And then I've slowly, over time, kind of started to accept the fact that I like the writing as much as the drawing. So, I'm dabbling in both ponds now.
Now, did the writing come from a desire to tell your own story or tell your own voice? Or did you get tired of listening to other people, you know, try to dictate how to tell your story or their story?
You know, it probably came most, it's from like fourth grade on, I was like obsessed with the comics page. So I know a lot of people, you know, come into all this through comics, like more like comic books. I sort of came in through the comics page. So I was obsessed with like Bloom County and all these strips declared early to my parents that that's what I wanted to do for a living. And fortunately I've gotten to do it. So I've done a couple of comic strips and then I think just from years of doing comic strips and writing jokes, I think it took me a long time to build up the confidence to try to write anything longer. So that's where it really came from is this desire to do a strip. And then I think once I did the strip, it was like, oh, now I have this desire to tell bigger stories.
So did your parents embrace the idea of you becoming an artist when you told them? Were they like, oh, that's such a wonderful idea? They were like, oh, crap.
They embraced it. And my dad was very insistent that I have a backup plan. And now that I'm older, I totally get it. When I went to college, he was like, what about political science? Like I kept saying I wanted to be like the next Gary Trudeau. And he's like, well, how about political science? Cause if it falls through, you can become a lawyer or something and go to law school. So I lasted about a semester in poli sci and then was like, nope, this is not for me. I'm supposed to be in art school or studying art. And so they've been incredibly supportive of it. But with a few road bumps, I think they struggled a little bit just because of the security part of it. I think they wanted me to have a smooth road.
Yeah, that sounds a lot. My father's probably watching this right now going, I told my son that too. when I told him, I think I was going to college, I was like, I'm going to be an anthropologist. He was like, okay, have a backup plan. I was like, Dad, I'm fine. I don't need a backup plan. I actually ignored him when he told me that. He's like, no. Backup plan as a teacher. That's the goal. So I ignored him, and 10 years later, I'm a teacher. So there it is.
There you go. Well, and I will say, I had a point right before I put out Monster on the Hill. I ended my first comic strip and suddenly found myself in a real bind. And I was in Austin at the time, Texas, and trying to find a job in advertising or creative agency or whatever. Couldn't find anything. And I was like, oh, God, he was right. He was absolutely 100% right. Like I put myself on a limb without a way back. And then my way out was I wrote Monster on the Hill, and it kind of started this next phase. So,
yeah. The power of desperation to get work done.
Absolutely. It's a motivator.
Yes, I imagine it would be. Yeah. So you studied art at DePaul University and illustration at Ringling College of Art and Design.
I did.
So what inspired attending these schools?
When I went to DePaul, my sister had gone to DePaul, but I kind of knew what a liberal arts education was, and I kind of wanted that sort of a well-rounded education. And like I said, I started out in poli sci and then sort of focused in on the art part. But I do think I got a really great education in all kinds of things being there. And then I got out of school and I had a t-shirt business with a friend for a year. And we did okay, but it was just kind of silly, for lack of a better word. And then I was obsessed with the idea of becoming an animator for Disney at that point. And so I went to Ringling because I knew that they had a really good placement program with Disney. And so I went there, and then I had all these other students telling me, you know, you should go into computer animation like us. And I kept saying, no, I think it's a fad. So I tried to stick with 2D animation. And then by the time I got out of school, through the illustration program, I actually had a few teachers that were like, you know what, I think you ought to kind of do your own thing. They're like, you know, you go there, you're going to draw somebody else's drawings for, you know, how many hours a day. I still would have loved to have done it. I tried out for it and I didn't get it. So maybe that's just sour grapes talking. I don't know. But I'm really glad where I ended up.
So you bet against computer animated movies. Yeah, not play the stock market.
I did. No, it was a bad call. You know what? Toy Story came out while I was in art school. And I think when I saw that one, I was like, oh, I see what they're doing. I may have made the wrong move here.
So. Well, I mean, obviously you came out extremely successful on your own without. I mean, in 2020, you published the book we're going to spend a lot of our time talking about, Monster on the Hill, which I'm saying is a great children's book. I had the pleasure of reading it, and I thought it was fantastically drawn, fantastically written. What inspired the creation of Monster on the Hill?
Well, actually, the first version of it came out in 2013, actually. So, there's a new version that has an extended thing. So I'll tell you what happened is I ended my first comic strip. It was called Big Top. It was about a kid in the circus. And I loved doing that strip. It hit all of my bases, and I had all of my little, you know, sub parts of my personality were represented in the characters, and it was really fun to do. But I ended it just, it wasn't, I'll just throw this out there. Towards the end of it, I got cancer, and I got through it. And then I had all these medical bills that piled up and piled up and piled up. And while I loved doing the strip, yeah, I was eking out a living doing it, and I was like, I need to do something else. So I quit doing the strip and started doing some odd jobs. I was in kind of a hole. I got in the funk. Thank God I survived the cancer and everything was okay there. But I found myself basically in a depression. And so Monster on the Hill was honestly a piece. I started out, I did this 7-page story called Melancholia, about this sad monster. And I kind of thought if I could do this book, it would be a way to write myself out of a hole. And if you read the book, there's sort of, if you read between the lines, there's a thinly veiled like depression, self-help book kind of hidden in the story. So that's really where it came from.
So Rayburn is based sort of on you?
Yeah, I mean, in the most roundabout way. I mean, you know, I think he's down on his luck, and he's kind of lost his, you know, mojo, for lack of it. So he ends up rediscovering, and in the book, it's not in the movie, but in the book, it turns out there's a real monster called the Merc. And in my mind, that's sort of the, like the really down deep stuff that you fight in depression, you know, the backstory and all that kind of stuff. And eventually he ends up having to fight the Merc. I guess loosely, very loosely based on myself.
Well, I mean, in reading Monster on the Hill, I really did feel it was a good allegory for how one overcomes depression. And I think in a lot of kids, I think, and as a teacher, I deal with a lot of high school kids who also deal with depression a lot as well.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to seeing how you handle him trying to combat that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in a 128 page graphic novel, it's hard to come at it with real depth. But I tried to show, I mean, some of the basic things that, like, you need to get up and move, you need to, learn to trust yourself. You need to lean on some friends. You need to, you know, maybe go out and re-engage with some of your old friends, things like that. And which were all things that worked for me. I mean, there were also antidepressants and things like that that worked too. And I didn't get into that in there, but I hope that it, if anything else, if nothing else, I hope that somebody would read it and relate and see themselves a little bit in the character.
So when you were conceiving of the concept, the message came first and then then the idea of the monsters, or did you have this vision of the monsters and then you thought of connecting it to something you've already dealt with?
You know, it all sort of developed around the same time. I had a job when I quit the strip. I was doing a job where I filmed public commission meetings in Texas, state meetings and stuff like that. And then the Texas school board, which was a horrifying thing to sit and watch from the back room. I'd get bored. I'd be in the back room. I would work the cameras remotely and I'd sit back there and draw on the back of the agendas and that sort of thing. And so, you know, while I was going through my own depression, I was drawing all these monsters and stuff. And I just remember one day I drew Rayburn and was like, oh, I like that. I like that character. Maybe I could do something around him. And it turned out I had all these other drawings I'd done. I don't know why I was drawing monsters, but it just, you know, it's one of those things when you're doodling, it's real easy to just draw a few lines and then be like, oh, okay, I'll turn this into this. So it all started out as a doodle and just a vague idea. And then I started honing it in.
Well, keep in mind, you're talking to someone who can't draw at all. Like, I draw only in squares and triangles and cubes. So yeah. I don't know how a doodle turns into a monster, but it looks visually very cool. And eventually we are going to mention the movie Rumble, but I will point out that the Rayburn in the graphic novel is so much cooler looking than the Rayburn in the movie.
I think part of the decision in changing his look was made that, you know, if we're going to have monsters wrestling, which wasn't part of the book either, you know, as they kept making changes, that would make other changes. There's sort of, domino effect. And I think they were like, oh, he needs to have like a big thick neck and be look like a meaty, you know, wrestling kind of guy. And I was like, why the neck, you know, being all droopy and all that is kind of cool. And you can actually put the person down, him down on the level with the kid he's talking to. They went their own way.
Well, I like how they're trying to develop physical rules for fictional monsters. Like, no. Yeah. The physiology of big muscles works exactly the same way in Monster World. It's like,
I'm like, have you seen the Godzilla movie? Like, those villains are not always built for speed or for fighting.
No, I will say I much preferred the book over the Rumble movie, and my wife felt the same way.
And you know what? I don't want to come off as too bitter about it, because I fought it for a while, and you know, when they kept putting out new scripts and all that, and I saw that it was getting further and further away from the book, and then I finally just had to sort of learn to let go and embrace what was happening. And I do think I think some of the monster designs in the movie are just crazy cool looking. But it turned into sort of a sports movie, which is not what my
book is. And I kind of felt they kind of shortchanged Rayburn a little bit. So I think what it is interesting, I think the kids helped a lot by the book, is the idea of battling the depression, the fear of failure, or having experience and having to overcome failure is, I think, a much bigger issue, I think, with students than I think the movie kind of danced around it a little bit more. And I kind of the book really kind of looked at it and said, here's the issue.
Yeah, it turned into more of a father issue, you know, daddy issues kind of thing, in the movie, and I feel like that maybe cut the legs out of the stakes for the thing, but you know, I knew from the very beginning my book is how can I put it, to animate it, I knew they were going to have to make it bigger. I knew they were going to have action scenes and, you know, crazy fights and all this kind of stuff. And I think there's a couple of those in the book, but I knew they'd have to blown it out. It was just interesting to watch the process because it was literally 8 years of, you know, and I think there were several directors involved and a ton of screenwriters. And it just kept slowly creeping away from what I had intended. But I'm trying not to be bitter or anything.
I totally get it. But I think the one thing that I missed from the book, not in the movie, as I mentioned earlier, is dealing with failure. Because once again, as a teacher, I think, and it's been discussed a lot in classroom, the idea of the fear, especially of going to like to the blackboard, the fear of failing at as a student, getting things wrong. And I think a lot of kids struggle with how to overcome the feeling of fear of being wrong in front of everybody in their classroom or losing at either a sport, so they want to go do that or whatever activity they look for. And I think Rayburn kind of speaks to that in the graphic novel of, you know, you can feel depression, you can fail, but there's a way out of that, and obviously due to friendships and everything else that he forms. But I think that was a wonderful lesson, I think, for students to learn. And like the only thing that made me a little sad was like, I missed it in the movie. I was like, I kind of wanted to see how they deal with that, because I think kids need that. And I don't think a lot of people talk about as adults, the fear of failure and accepting failure.
Yeah. Well, and that failure is part of what makes you stronger and makes you,
yes,
makes you, it's interesting because I was just talking with, it's not a podcast, but I'm about to do this video thing with a guy and we were talking about ideas for it. And he was talking about the creative process and just how, what is your creative process? And I was like, well, I dive in, screw things up royally, and then I just keep fixing it and then keep diving back in and fixing and diving back in and fixing. And it's like, if it wasn't for failure, I wouldn't have any of the books I've done. My book, two books ago, this Wink, which is about, it's loosely based on my cancer experience, but it's set in middle school. But that book, I wrote 20 versions of that book. It landed in different places and I wanted it to be a funny book, but it's about cancer. So I had all these times where it just felt like, nah, it's not right. It's not right. And I think failure is essential to success. I really do.
And I think anyone who attempts anything, a creative endeavor, has to learn to deal with it. Or almost any endeavor. I mean, as when I'm not teaching, I write comic books, and I've been rejected and more than I've been accepted. And I think, once again, if you're going to try to do anything and be successful at it, you got to overcoming failure, I think, is the biggest hurdle to success. We all are going to fail eventually. We're all going to be told we suck eventually. And that's the point where you just, the dividing line between those who success and so those who fail is how you handle that one moment when someone told you you suck.
Yep. Well, and then I just think also, as much as the failure is a part that overcoming the fear of failure, like you said, I just think if you have that fear of failure, you'll never start. And so I think that's a huge lesson for kids. It's interesting. This is for much younger kids, but I have a friend, Mark Pat, who does children's books, and he has a picture book, and he did it with a smaller publisher, and it's been hugely successful. And it's called The Girl Who Never Made Mistakes. And it's all about this girl who's perfect, and then it's charming. It really is. And it deserves the success it's had, because it just continues to sell well and all that. And I think it's just so many parents see that book and they're like, yep, my kids needs this one. Cause it's about this girl who was just perfect. And then she screws up and it almost derails her, but she pulls back.
Well, like I said, I start every class beginning of the school year with when I have new students. I teach at a therapeutic high school for kids with anxiety and depression and a bunch of other issues that like that. And so I had the same students for all 4 years of high school, but my first time I have them in a year, I do have a PowerPoint. One thing I talk about as a slide is the importance of being wrong, and that it's okay to be wrong. And that's one of the first thing I start with, because I'm trying to encourage the kids, be wrong. I'm wrong all the time. I'll say something and I'll realize, oh shit, that wasn't really the best. I got to rephrase, fix it, correct myself the next day. I try to get them to accept wrongness so they can hopefully get encouraged to answer the questions in class and, obviously take being wrong, which I think is the biggest. The kids that are so anxiety filled with just being embarrassed in front of their classmates.
Anxiety seems like an epidemic. So like I said, that book was about so I'm about to gear up to write another novel, and I'm like, I think I want to take on anxiety, just because I've got so many friends who have kids that are in middle school and high school right now, and it is a full-on epidemic of anxiety. It just seems like they're all, they get, my best friend, I watch his son just get bogged down trying to do homework, and he gets freaked out and, you know, beats up on himself and all that, and I think, yeah, I mean, man, if I was never wrong, I'd never speak, because, you know, I say things wrong and correct myself as they're coming out of my mouth. I've done it since we've been talking several times. So, yeah.
Well, if you ever want to talk to some students for a guest speaker, we have Zoom meetings once a month.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to, because and I've dealt with anxiety and depression my whole life, too. I think, it's just something you overcome in time, although, you know, it's always there, but you just got to learn to manage it. So,
yeah. And I'm going to hold you to that, by the way, since you said it on air.
Okay. Yeah. I'm in.
I think another cool character that you have in your book that I think builds upon the lessons of overcoming fear, and it is also another great metaphor for how you overcome fear and failure, is, to me, at least I think it was connected, is Dr. Wilkie.
Yeah.
Who is a failure in many ways, because he lost his medical license because he screwed up somehow. And now he's being asked to now try again and help Rayburn, and kind of given a second chance. And I think Dr. Wilkie is another great example of, I think, that theme of overcoming fear and failure. Am I correct in that those connections?
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, in some ways he's given a second chance, and in some ways he's being thrown to the wolves, like, hey, go up the hill and talk to that monster. And unfortunately, Rayburn turns out to be a pretty decent guy. So I think his arc is meaningful to me too. And again, you know, all this came out of this dark place I was in when I wrote it, or started writing it. And it honestly did. It made me feel better. I love these characters, and I loved. So there's something. It was therapeutic for me. So my hope is, if it's therapeutic for me, it'll be so for someone else. I should also say, it's also just fun. I don't mean it to sound like it's, just one lesson piled on top of another. I think Wilkie, I love that character, and I'm sad he didn't make it to the movie. Like I said, about 5 years ago, I let go of all that. I was like, okay, this is what it is. This is what the movie is now. I just don't want anybody to ever read the book and then go see the movie and be like, I love the book. Why did they, so I want people to know that it's loosely based.
Well, hopefully they'll make a actual version of the book at some point and keep Wilkie in it. One thing I thought was really cool to do about the Dr. Wilkie story, and I don't know if this is part of how you intended it or just kind of works in the overall story, is that here's a character who, as you said, and we mentioned, did fail, and he was asked to try again. That people didn't just give up on him and say, well, you're a failure, get out of here. They did give him a second chance to do something else. And I think, once again, I enjoyed that lesson as well, which is, no one's just going to alienate you because you fucked up one time. You know, you're welcome back. Try again.
I think that is part of it, because people are forgiven. People just, are probably less, that's a huge lesson, is that people are less concerned with you than they are with themselves. So, people have short memories when it comes to failure. They'll ask you again. And this one pays off huge. He ends up, doing pretty well.
I think it's fascinating that, at least I think, that people are far less forgiving with themselves than other people are forgiving of you. I think people tend to be more forgiving of you yourself than you are ever of yourself. And we have this imagination that, everyone's going to think we're horrible. People could be screwed up and they're going to be angry at us and never forgive us. But it turns out most people are pretty cool. They're like, it happens. And it's us who are actually the problem, worrying about ourselves.
Well, part of it is they're busy beating up on themselves about something they've done. So I think,
that's true.
It's this vicious cycle where we're all, on some level, in our heads and too much. So they don't have time to obsess about what you did wrong. They're obsessing about what they did wrong. So
that is true.
Yeah. I was thinking about that, like the night after a party, if there have been some drinks involved or something like that, you know, and you wake up feeling like, oh God, what did I say or whatever. Well, no, everybody else is doing the same thing.
They can't remember it either. That's true. I mean, in many ways, our view is very self-absorbed, as far as we are very concerned with ourselves. And it takes a while for us to realize we're not the center of everyone else's world. They don't think that hard about it when you did.
Right. And I think as a kid, that lesson is a long time coming. I'm still learning it. You know, I still have to remind myself daily that people aren't as worried about me as I am about myself. So, yeah.
I agree. And so another interesting character in the book is Timothy, the young boy who's also describe him as a street urchin, who's very important to helping Rayburn. Now, because he's a very optimistic character. He's a very good friend to Rayburn. So would you say that his the belief in Rayburn, would that come from innocence, ignorance, or faith in that everyone has a special gift? Like, which one do you think is the one that's focused on?
Probably the last one. I think he just, to me, he's a little bit of the heart of the story, and that he just has this sort of eternal optimism of, you know, or it's almost like forced optimism. Like he just is like, we can do it. And I think, you know, in my head, I hear that Cockney accent. That's how I picture him, as being this like super up, like, let's go, let's do it. So maybe a little bit of innocence, but also just a belief that, with enough, you know, elbow grease, we can get this done, that sort of thing. So he's a little Pollyanna-ish, I guess, or something in that way. If I'm using that word right, that's one that always confuses me, but I think that's where I come down with him. But I intended him, or as I wrote it, I just saw him as this sort of guiding positive force through the book. And even when he's, you know, griping and stuff like that, I thought it was fun to have him be the griping voice of optimism.
So the story itself is Stokerathon is set in roughly a fantasy version of 1860 England.
Yeah.
So what was about that setting, that time period, that you thought this is the kind of like the feel I want for this story?
Yeah, I'm a huge like fan of Godzilla and all those kind of movies. And then I'm also a huge reader, and a lot of books that I like, and especially at that period, at that time, when I just read like three or four books set in, you know, 1800s England. And I just love that time period. One of the books was Drood by Dan Simmons. That's about Dickens is in there, and Edwin Drood, and the writing of that. And anyway, this mysterious guy that he meets and all that. I just love that time period. And one day I think I just was brainstorming, like, you know, you always see Godzilla hit a modern city and, you know, stomp in there. And I thought, that would be so cool to see a monster movie where it attacks in 1800s England or something, you know, we're like, and so I just like the juxtaposition of the two. And and because I like that time period so much, I felt like I could kind of write, and, at least in the cartoon version of that voice, you know, that's the nice thing, is that you don't have to be too, when it's sort of a fantasy England, you don't have to be too tied down to reality. So it was two of my favorite things that I got to play with.
So as you mentioned a little bit, there's two versions of this story. There's a regular version and an expanded version.
Yeah.
So what happened to expand it? What did you expand upon versus what was in the regular? Like what brought about the decision to do so?
It was you know, at one point I had an idea for a book two, Monster on the Hill book two. And I still do have this idea, and I still think it would be fun to do at some point. But then the movie came along, and the movie was so radically different that it's like, well, do I do that second version of the book and just hope that people have read the book? And, you know, so I'm still arguing with myself on that at times. But then when the movie was coming out, we thought about trying to do some kind of a tie-in, and we were kicking ideas around. And, you know, the idea of them putting like the monsters from the movie on the cover wasn't really appealing to me, because it's just, that's not what's inside the book. And then I had this idea. I was like, well, I think there were a few loose ends that can get tied up in the epilogue. And so I came up with this. I just wrote up this quick 10-page epilogue. And I even take like a little shot at the movie. Like a lighthearted, well-intended jab where they're like, hey, did you hear so-and-so starting up a wrestling league? But you get to hear, you see a little bit more about what happens with Timothy and how, what their lives are like a year later. To me, that was just, maybe I should have put it in the first book, but it felt natural to me to do it.
So once again, going back to the juxtaposition between the movie and the book, when you were having discussions with the studio about the movie, were there specific themes that were pushed, then it has to at least cover these ideas, it should at least have these elements to it?
You know what, unfortunately I got sort of an education a little bit on what it means to sell your option to Hollywood, and the option came in 2013 when the book first came out, to be honest, I was talking about all those medical bills. I was like, oh my God, Hollywood wants to send me a check, a very small check, but it was like, hey, this is amazing. And then what I didn't really realize at the time, and I have a film agent who helped me out with it. I've talked with him since then. He's like, well, I didn't really warn you too much about, that it could change dramatically, that they kind of take the reins once they pay that. Option money. He said, I didn't really warn you, but I've never had it happen like this where they change something so dramatically, because if they're going to buy the book, you think that they would stick. And I think the people who initially bought it wanted to make my book, but they were, the first of a line of producers and directors and people. I didn't really get to say that. Now, that said, they had me out a couple of times and I got to see what they were working, and they took my advice or asked my advice on some things. I think they do their own thing, and they're doing something very different. I'm trying to keep you entertained for a, 185 page graphic novel. They want to keep kids butts in seats watching it. Whether that's successful or not, I think they know what they're going for. And so, it's apples and oranges, I guess.
So
did I tiptoe around that? I just bent over backwards trying to be, yeah.
I think you did a fantastic job of parsing your words just enough to make it all work. Okay. But like I said, I can understand. I mean, I guess that would be in many ways the true Hollywood experience that you hear. It was like, hey, we're going to, take every, idea. We're going to change that, things like that. Sort of like back in the days of the comic book movie world, where they're like, yeah, we're going to do the comic book character, then change every single aspect of the character. Right. And make it ours. We're like, all right, whatever. But,
yeah. We did talk about several times when I was out there, I kept saying, if we can just keep the spirit of the thing and I think they did. I think on some level, that there is still that underdog story, and there's still that thing about coming to believe in yourself and that sort of thing. We've seen that in other animated movies too, I think. It came out in a different way in the movie, but that was one of the things that was important to me. And I think they knew, I had told them why I wrote the book, so I think on some level that remained a guiding light in there.
Was Dr. Wilkie and Timothy in any version of the movie as it was being developed?
There was a Dr. Wilkie, but he had become the mayor, and he was a little different in one version. One version had sort of a Western feel to it. It was interesting. There was sort of there was this gang of outlaws kind of.
Outlaw monsters?
No, they had their own monster. So it almost wasn't like they didn't have their own town. They were like a wandering group of outlaws that had their own monster. And Timothy got switched to Winnie pretty quickly. And I think that's all based on what's been out there recently and that sort of thing. And they thought, and they aged her up a little bit. I think, again, they're looking at different things. They're looking at who's going to want to see this movie.
So in your mind, why do you think the monsters are such good surrogates for children and a good surrogate way to help children?
Well, as a kid, I was super into monsters. You know, I still am on some level. So you know, I think there's something about them. Part of what I love, you know, the hook, I guess, in my book, is that in my book, each town has its own monster that will come into town and just knock stuff around and scare everybody real bad, and they love it because it's sort of like their tourist attraction, or, you know, people come from town to town to get scared, mm-hmm. and then they buy their tentacular dolls and all the stuff. I think kids, we're all sort of wrecking balls going through life. And so, you know, maybe there's a little bit of that I think, and I love the idea of a bad guy who's actually, I mean, I just love the idea of a monster that comes in and knocks things around. And then, you know, I could even see it spinning out in a way where it's like, okay. And then they have this small little, you know, community of people who then go in and fix the buildings up real quick and all that stuff afterwards, you know. Anyway, I think for kids, it gets their attention having monsters, and then to see one have this big, huge monster that has insecurities and things like that, I think is could hopefully resonate with a kid.
So, is there plans for a Monster on the Hill 2 book?
Not immediate plans. I'm doing a series of books now called Bat Pig. That's about this superhero pig. And the first one's out now, and I've got a couple more. I'm working on finishing a book 3. But after that, all bets are off. I don't have anything lined up. And I do have an idea. I've written up a whole synopsis for a Monster on the Hill book 2. And they might come to America. There's a that time period again in America would be an interesting time to have some monsters and across, you know, crossing the ocean, that sort of thing. So I have ideas. We'll just see. Cause I will say, out of all the books I've done, Monster on the Hill probably took the longest. It was also my first graphic novel. So it felt like, this huge learning curve. So I can do them a little bit faster now. I told my wife when I started the art on it, I said, well, you may not see me in much for the next 6 months. And then 2 years later, I got the artwork done. and I was like, oh, did I undershoot the, you know, the time that was going to take? But someday.
So Bat Pig, it's coming out June 2022. And it's
Second one will be out June 22. The first one's out now, actually.
Yeah, it's about Too Big to Fail.
Yeah, Too Big to Fail. Yeah, it's coming out in June. This is the new one This came out in November. Yeah.
So Too Big to Fail sounds like, once again, you're going to talk about one of the themes again of failure. Is that correct?
It was mostly just a pun on Bat Pig, or on Too Big to Fail. So, it does. It definitely does. And I think the character of Bat Pig, he sort of came about organically from my novel, because the kid drew this character Bat Pig, and then he's sort of now spun off to his own series. But he's a really identifiable character. I aim the books at like slightly older than like Dog Man books, if you know the Dog Man books. But I think I've written them to hopefully where they're funny for anybody who picks them up. But yeah, there are some definite lessons in there, and there's two stories in each book. The one I'm working on now, he goes up against Sharkraham Lincoln, who is a half great white shark and half Abraham Lincoln.
Of course.
So he has like the mind of our greatest president, but he also wants to eat baby seals and stuff like that. So he's got his hands full. Yeah.
That's really cool. It sounds really cool. And I highly recommend our listeners, especially if you have, like I said, if you have kids, get a Monster on the Hill. It's a great graphic novel. I think it was fantastically well written, well drawn.
Thanks.
Check out Rumble, because, you know.
I think Rumble's really cool. I think, and everybody I know who has kids said their kids have absolutely loved it. And I think I know at one point there were plans to make toys, and I wish they would, because I want some of them, because the monsters are just so cool that they designed in there. So it's a fun movie.
Well, hopefully they make a Rumble 2, because hopefully you get some of that money out of any sequels that they do.
Sure.
So hopefully a sequel gets made. Mr. Harrell, it was fantastic talking with you, and I look forward to doing it again. When next time you want to promote Bad Pig when it comes out or anything like that, come right back on. Well, I'll be glad to have you.
Hey, thank you so much. This was really fun.
Definitely my pleasure, sir. Have a fantastic night.
Okay, you too.